I'm Jen Psaki. Welcome to Diplopod.
I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being.
It's because we don't run and hide when there's a problem. Because we don't react to our fears, but instead we respond with common sense and skill and courage.
American exceptionalism is a claim about history. American exceptionalism is a claim about what happened in the American founding.
I don't know of any other nation that is as self-correcting, self-aware, as willing to make change in order to live up to our founding principles as we are. We know we're not perfect. We don't claim to be perfect, but we are exceptional.
A lot of politicians from both sides of the aisle have defined American exceptionalism and what it means over the years. I sat down with Jake Sullivan to talk about this concept and why he's so optimistic about what the next president can do to regain America's role in the world. Well, Jake Sullivan, thanks for joining us in the Diplopod studio. Fun to have you here in person since you're a New Hampshire resident now.
Right. No, very excited to be down in D.C. for a little while.
Jumping in and out is always a good thing in Washington.
Right, exactly.
So you recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic, What Donald Trump and Dick Cheney Got Wrong About American Exceptionalism, and I want to dive deeply into that. Let's start at the beginning. Where did that phrase come from, and why? How did it take on a negative connotation?
Well, a little-known historical fact is that the phrase American exceptionalism was actually coined by Joseph Stalin. Of all things.
Oh, who knew?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think he's being, accredited.
Yeah, right. And it initially emerged in a conversation he had with a senior American communist leader decades ago when Stalin was still in power. And he bemoaned the fact of, quote unquote, American exceptionalism. And what he meant by it was that the United States had a unique set of attributes that made it impervious to communist revolution. Mm-hmm. That there was an American exceptionalism, and this is what the communist leader from the United States was telling him, and Stalin was essentially saying, I don't want to hear about this American exceptionalism. I want you to do something about it. I want you to undermine American democracy and, you know, be a fifth column from within and the like. So the phrase starts with Stalin. You could say it goes all the way back to Alexis de Tocqueville, who didn't use the phrase American exceptionalism, but did say that the position of the Americans was exceptional and no other people in history had been put in a place like it. And what he meant by that was that the blessings of geography and the opportunity to build a new nation based on ideas and not simply on territory and tribe was something we'd never seen before. In the years that followed, people sort of forgot that a French guy and a Soviet dictator were the ones who really introduced exceptionalism into the discourse. And it took on a whole variety of different meanings. It meant everything from the kind of issues related to American democracy to these geographical dimensions of the United States that I was talking about earlier, to specific American attributes like industriousness or religiosity, to this kind of manifest destiny argument that some people made about the United States being blessed by divine providence, some kind of more absurd type arguments. All of them fell under the cloak of, broadly speaking, American exceptionalism. But I would say that more recently, it has taken on a kind of chest-beating, prideful cast, and that's the Dick Cheney version, which is, as he says in his book, which was called Exceptional, America has unmatched goodness and greatness. Okay, like this is a statement that we are better than, superior to any other country.
And how's that heard around the world? I mean, given
I think that's not heard well around the world. I think other people look at that and say, excuse me, you know, first of all, any other observer from any other part of the world can point to a whole series of failures, flaws, and foibles in American foreign policy, in American society, in American democracy. Secondly, they can also say, since when do you get to declare yourself as being superior to or better than us?
Right.
And this is why I wanted to write this piece, because I do believe very strongly that the United States has distinctive attributes that are distinct and different from any other major power in history. And I don't think we should ignore those or push those aside. I think we should define them with care and reclaim this idea of exceptionalism not as superiority, but as distinctiveness, as some set of qualities that our country has, some set of capacities mm-hmm. and attributes that we can apply to serve our own national interests, but also to try to help make the world a better place. And you know, on this point, I actually align fairly closely with our former boss, President Obama, who gave a speech on American exceptionalism in Selma, and mm-hmm. where he really focused on how imperfection, in a way, is at the heart of American mm-hmm. exceptionalism, that we are always trying to do better, trying to improve and self-correct, and that this is a distinctive feature of the American story over the course of decades and centuries. And so it's a much more humble, more modest, and more constrained form of the concept than the one you've seen put forward by someone like a Dick Cheney.
Sure. And that was one of the things that struck me about the piece, too, is you talk, and I'd never thought about it this way, although the Selma speech, obviously, I remember, about it being aspirational, that we're not saying this is who we are. This is saying who we want to be. And part of that is telling the world this is who we want to be and hopefully bringing some of them with us as a part of it, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, it has this really interesting phrase, to form a more perfect union, a more perfect union.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an odd phrase, less perfect, more perfect, perfect. It wasn't a phrase to form a perfect union or to establish a perfect union. It was a more, it was always about the process of improving. And the Constitution itself is designed to have amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And the arc of those amendments is toward greater inclusivity, more rights for more people, a more enlightened approach to our democracy. And you can read from the First Amendment down to the 27th Amendment and see that progress through our history as we've overcome some enormous tragedies and sins mm-hmm. from slavery to denying women the right to vote and many, many more. And we've taken steps to improve and we have to keep improving. And the only other thing I would say is that part of my metric for why I do think America is a distinctive power compared with other powers is that people have an expectation of the U.S. that we're going to try to live up to mm-hmm. these ideals, even if we constantly fall mm-hmm. short. You don't see people saying about China or Russia, gosh, they've really fallen short of, you know,
right.
some...
They used to be great on human rights.
Something we've held them up to.
Right.
You know, we don't measure those countries, nor did we measure Imperial Rome mm-hmm. or the British Empire in the 19th century by the standards that we measure the United States by. And it's because the rest of the world also sees that aspiration and also hopes the U.S. will one day do a better job of living up to that aspiration. And that's why, you know, I cite in my piece a woman named Susie Hansen, who wrote a very interesting book, deeply critical of U.S. foreign policy. And it's a book that we should all take seriously because mm-hmm. it points out and makes some very strong arguments about failures of U.S. foreign policy and blind spots. But in it, she refers to having a broken heart mm-hmm. about the U.S. approach to foreign policy. That phrase really stood out to me because a broken heart suggests that there's an aspiration, that there's an expectation, that there's a standard we're holding our country to.
That there's a hope that we'll meet
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And look, it's, you know, when you have a broken heart, it's hard to have someone come along and say, well, at least you had hope.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not the most powerful argument in
right.
the world, of course. But I think it does say something important about this being, no, not an expression of current reality, but a statement of aspiration and ambition about who we can be and who we should strive to be in our approach to the world.
So part of the challenge here is obviously the political debate from all sides, right? You have kind of the Republican Party led by Trump sort of arguing that we've been taken advantage of, that we need to have America first leading. You talk about this a bit in your piece. And you have some on the left suggesting, you know, we are imperfect. We can't be pronouncing to the world that we are and that we're better than everyone else. How do we navigate that?
It's really hard. And in fact, one of the earlier drafts of my piece actually pretended to try to tackle this political
yeah.
question and to say, I have a set of suggestions for how right. to talk about these
Everyone
things.
Everyone sing kumbaya.
And I kind of took it out and made it more of just an argument of what I believe.
Sure.
Because I think It is very difficult to push back against America First in a kind of clean and pithy way because, you know, you don't really want to be standing up for America Second or Third or Fifth or Ninth or whatever.
Right.
And of course, the national interest should play a central role in America's foreign policy decision making. But what I am trying to do in making this case about renewing and reclaiming American exceptionalism is essentially say there is no contradiction between patriotism and internationalism, between the national interest and the global common interest, that these two things can reinforce each other, and that, in fact, at its best, American foreign policy over the decades, when we've actually achieved successes, we've achieved them through this kind of positive sum thinking, that what when other countries are better and safer and stronger and more prosperous, we can end up better and safer and stronger and more prosperous. And that led us to do everything from rebuild our vanquished enemies after the Second World War to engage in PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief that has saved the lives of millions of people in Africa. And it's not mere altruism. It's about building a global community that is more stable, more resilient, more successful, because we're all better off when that happens. And so I guess my view is that just responding to Donald Trump by saying, I don't like America First, but I also think America kind of sucks, you know, which I worry about from some quarters in this debate, I don't think is going to succeed because Americans want to be inspired. They want to be called to a greater purpose, to a higher purpose, even if we're not going to get all the way there as we were talking about before. And so part of the argument I'm making is I'm not just pushing back against the chest-beating proponents of this excessive form of exceptionalism that came before. I'm also pushing back against the cynical critics who say, no, the United States isn't capable of being a country that lives up to a greater extent than it has in the past, its highest ideals, and isn't capable of making unique and decisive contributions, and even to being a force for good in the world, which is a phrase I think we should use unapologetically because that should be our aim.
And you talk in the piece, and you've done work on this here at Carnegie, on the disconnect between the middle class, the struggles people are dealing with every day, and what is happening in the Situation Room. And, you know, I think for listeners, it's very unique for any – there are few people who are have lived in the Situation Room and been a part of foreign policy decision making who have actually spent time, months, years in America campaigning with a presidential candidate and really seeing how things are digested and impacted. How can we fix that? I mean, what would you say to the Jake Sullivan of the next president? What can they do better to help be more connected?
Well, the first thing is to not view domestic issues and issues related to the health and well-being of the American middle class as somebody else's problem, which honestly, candidly, I think Republican and Democratic administrations have done for a long time. The national security folks say, the domestic policy folks handle that. I handle China and ISIS and Middle East peace or whatever. I think getting people coming in and saying a strong, vibrant American middle class is not just necessary for us to maintain strength and credibility in the world, but actually what we do in the world matters for helping reinforce and shore up the strength of that middle class at home. And that goes for everything from international economic policy to the way that we structure our relationship with countries like China to how we decide to allocate our resources in fighting wars. And in all of those cases, we should be sitting around the Situation Room table saying, what is the impact of this decision, not just on questions of war and peace and security, but actually on the vitality of America's most precious national asset, which is a strong and healthy middle class. And I think if you start from that mindset, you can then put a process in place where actually you have the foreign policy types and the economic policy types sitting together and working out what one might call a grand strategy for the United States that integrates foreign and domestic in a much more effective way than I think we have done through administrations past. You know, and I'm struck by when I was thinking back on my time in the administration and how much we siloed these things.
Yeah.
President Obama didn't silo them. He was the one guy because he had to deal with all of it.
Sure.
And Vice President Biden also. I mean, these when they would sit in the Oval Office or they would sit in the Situation Room, they were the guys who saw across the span. And they would chide us. You know, if we'd have a meeting on Afghanistan and say, how about another $15 billion for whatever it was, you know, they would say, for you national security types, you don't have to think about or you're not thinking about the trade-offs.
Yeah.
But from President Obama's perspective, $15 billion for Kandahar means $15 billion less for kindergarten funding or whatever it is. So I think presidents, vice presidents, the people at the top of the totem pole see this, but the system is not built to serve them as effectively as it could be.
And it's interesting, as much as I certainly did not sit in as nearly as many of those meetings, but having been around it enough to see that even when President Obama or Vice President Biden made those points, sometimes they were looked at as being political, right? Because you're talking about, oh, the middle class in Ohio, or how do you think that will be digested in Scranton, you know, Vice President Biden's statement. And it's like, oh, he's being political, when really it isn't, right? It is trying to articulate whether it's in the national interest to move forward in policies.
Well, right. I mean, because, you know, if you're elected president of the United States or vice president of the United States, you're elected to serve people who voted for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're elected to serve all the people. But, like, you have to be responsive to their aspirations, their needs, their fears. And there's nothing political in saying – we need to be tying our decisions about what we're doing overseas to how it is actually going to help and support the progress and prosperity of our people here at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our elected leaders get that, but national security professionals have gotten very comfortable operating within a set of parameters where they leave that all for someone else to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, TPP to me is a great example of this because all of us went around making the case for TPP on strategic grounds. Mm-hmm. This is important for the future of the Asia Pacific, for the future of our relationship with allies and with China. If somebody had said to almost any of us national security types, okay, but what's actually in the document? Like, what's in it? And what does it do for a small business owner or a manufacturing worker or a services worker somewhere in the United States? We wouldn't have been able to tell you. Now, that doesn't mean it wasn't a good thing, but it does mean that we haven't fully taken on our responsibility to have a 360-degree view of the choices that we are making, the policies we're advocating for. And that's why a lot of the work that I've been doing here with colleagues at Carnegie has been focused on this issue, on how you reconnect American foreign policy decision-making with the needs, aspirations, hopes, fears of the American middle class.
Yeah, and there's a benefit not just to the foreign policy community, but domestically. I mean, there's always this aid. You and I have both spent time at the State Department. There's always an initiative about, you know, communicating about the benefit of foreign policy to the public. And it can be actually, you guys, the economic straits statecraft work was quite good, but it still is hard. And it's hard to move the needle. And some of it needs to be showing that the foreign policy community cares about what's happening in these communities and is thinking about
it. Exactly.
It's as simple as that.
When you go out, and we just did a case study in Ohio, and you talk to people in Coshocton, Ohio, who work on economic development, you know, they'll sort of say, like, you people sitting out there in Washington aren't really thinking about me. And I don't think that that was true of the domestic policy folks, right? I do think in Washington they're thinking about those people. But I think it is somewhat true of the national security folks, and that's an error that we need to correct as we go forward. And I'm passionate about putting in the intellectual effort now to contribute to the work of the administration that comes after Trump to be able to actually take this insight that the line between foreign and domestic has become blurred, that we've got to reconnect the choices we're making abroad to the people we're serving here at home, to actually put that into practice. And and I, you know, I really hope that that becomes a hallmark of the next administration.
And part of the debate over the next year.
And yes,
year
something
plus.
That candidates who are seeking the presidency going into 2020 on both sides are taking on.
Doing some thinking about. Yeah. Trump is probably not calling you for your advice. I'm just
guessing.
Probably
not. Right?
But the others may.
Yeah.
So you one another interesting point you raise is about aspirations, even of the national security apparatus, and whether Syria is the example you talk about, which I thought was quite interesting, whether our aspirations were too high for what were possible. You know, there's been a lot of navel gazing about Syria and what we did or didn't do, but can you talk about that a little bit and how you reflected on that?
Yeah, look, you know, I've really struggled with this, and I'll be the first to say I still don't have answers I can give with great confidence about what exactly went wrong and what we should have done differently. It is a terrible, tragic situation, a humanitarian catastrophe of just epic proportions. And I still lose sleep, as many of my colleagues do, over, you know, the question, could we have done something to prevent this, mm-hmm. to reduce the suffering, the killing, the gassing? And so I've struggled. But with that preface, where I've arrived, at least provisionally, is that our error was not simply a question of should we have done more or less, but what was our objective?
Mm-hmm.
And we came out swinging at the beginning and said, Assad must go. We're going to have a transition to a new democratic government in Syria, mm-hmm. and we won't accept anything less. And I've basically concluded
And the unplanned red line language, which
well, right. And
there
then
was that
saying,
too.
You know, it's a red line to use chemical weapons. And if you
right.
do, you know, they'll be
right.
held to pay. I've basically concluded on Syria that we should have done more to accomplish less,
mm-hmm.
meaning we should have applied more and earlier pressure on Assad, got more engaged more quickly, but not to produce regime change and a whole new government and everything else, but rather to bring the conflict to an end, to
mm-hmm.
force a negotiation that reduced violence and managed some longer-term political process that didn't require us to go out and assert Assad must go tomorrow, he
mm-hmm.
must go at the beginning of any negotiation, et cetera. If we had done that, if we had closed the gap between means and ends from both sides, increased the means and narrowed the ends, I think we might have had more success. And your question is an important one because this is not just about Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a broader issue with American foreign policy,
mm-hmm.
where we tend to have maximalist ends
mm-hmm.
Because we like to think of things in these big, ambitious
terms.
Do
you think that's about selling it to the public or the world, or it is just about we believe in the strength and capacity of what we can get done?
Honestly, I think it's a very American attribute. Just it's in our – there's a cultural dimension
mm-hmm.
to this that we're very gee whiz about
mm-hmm.
the way we approach things. We see problems anywhere in the world and we say, gosh, how are we going to go out and
mm-hmm.
solve that thing? And we are a nation full of problem solvers and a world full of problems. And sometimes we fail to recognize the drivers that created those problems, the constraints
mm-hmm.
on solving them, and we get ourselves in trouble. Because we bite off more than we can chew.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things I think to channel that problem-solving attitude, which I think is a very important attitude, in the right direction is to be more both consistent and rigorous in saying, okay, we can achieve this much. Going further is a stretch. And that's a hard conversation for us to have in U.S. foreign policy.
Right.
But I think it's an increasingly necessary one, and it will lead to better outcomes. And then succeeding against narrower objectives
mm-hmm.
creates momentum that allows us, you know, winning begets winning. And so I think that should become a hallmark of American strategy as we go forward.
Yeah, I remember when President Obama made the comment about singles and doubles, which was largely very broadly panned.
Right.
And it wasn't articulated in the right way, but I think a version of that may have been what he meant.
Yeah. And look, I think what people misunderstood with President Obama's observation about singles and doubles was they thought he was describing the totality of American foreign
mm-hmm.
policy, that all American foreign policy is hoping to do is hit a single or a double. But that's misunderstanding the analogy. Obama wants to win the baseball game.
Right.
He wants to achieve a just and sustainable international order that safeguards American security and values our allies and, you know, creates global progress for all. Big, ambitious ends. And what he's arguing is the way you get from here to there is not swinging for the fences at every pitch that comes across the plate. And I think he is absolutely right on that. And that applied in the Syria context, I think could have produced a better strategy than the one we ultimately pursued. Mm-hmm. And while that would not have solved all of the problems of Syria, it may have reduced the violence in material ways.
It would have been a difficult political conversation here, but some of these will have to be.
Yeah. And I think being more honest and straightforward with people in general about these issues is something that Americans should get more comfortable being able to do. Just one anecdote on this front. I met with a group of Bahraini human rights activists during the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And they said, why, you know, America should be going all in with us. You believe in democracy and human rights and values. Why aren't you going all in with us? And I sort of read the talking points in this meeting. And I wasn't even really believing entirely what I was saying. Mm-hmm. And so finally I said, look, let me just be completely honest with you. We actually sincerely do believe in democracy and human rights and in your aspirations. But we also have security interests in the regions, in the region, including a base in Bahrain. Mm. And so the real issue is not, are we going to trade one off against the other? It's how do we manage to deal with both our interests and our values at the same time? Let's have a conversation about that. And one of the guys actually gave me a hug and said, thank you, because like that's honest.
Yeah.
And now we can proceed and have a real conversation about how you can be a partner to us and help us and support us within the constraints of your current policymaking. And I just think if the United States in general was willing to stand up and say, we are not perfect in the way that we carry out or reflect our values in our foreign policy, but leaving this current administration aside, it is a genuine and important factor mm-hmm. in what we do, that would lead to more productive conversations mm-hmm. with people around the world. Mm-hmm.
Well, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about if there's a Democratic president next. We don't know. It's a long journey to the election. What are a couple of the things they should do early on to reset our role in the world, to repair, in some cases, some of what's happened over the last couple of years?
So I think the number one thing that a new president should do is reassert something that Donald Trump has called into question, which is that America is committed to its democratic partners and allies around the world. And here I'm not just talking about NATO.
Mm-hmm.
I am, although that
That's
is a
part
very
of
important
it. Sure.
Relationship. I am talking about a community of nations that believes in shared values
mm-hmm.
of pluralism and the dignity of the individual and freedom of speech and assembly and religion, and that shares a common vision for a way a free people govern themselves. And a president should come out and say, this is something we are going to be absolutely committed to against all of the forces that are currently pushing against them,
mm-hmm.
whether they come from states like Russia and China, from terrorist groups, from changes in technology that are eroding some of our democratic mm-hmm. freedoms. So that's number one. Then I think there's a couple of hard policy issues that the next president will have right at the top of their
mm-hmm.
agenda. One is, how do you actually develop, now it will be by the time they take office, just about 20 years after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
a sustainable counterterrorism strategy that does not have us deploying thousands, mm-hmm. if not tens of thousands of troops overseas, in multiple countries
mm-hmm.
spanning multiple continents.
Right.
How do we keep our country safe but not be in this forever war?
Mm-hmm.
That is a very hard strategic and operational question. And I would say,
because it would be reducing our presence in certain places.
It would.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just say, well, we're pulling back. It's got to be figuring out what tools you're enhancing even
mm-hmm.
as you try to diminish the degree to which mm-hmm. the military is the centerpiece of our counterterrorism strategy. So I would argue anyone who wants to be president in 2021 should be taking the next 2 years to develop not just a talking points answer to that question, but a real answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other issue is U.S.-China, because that is going to be the defining bilateral relationship of the 21st century. And it'll be easy on the campaign trail to demonize China
right.
and to get into a rhetorical arms race with Donald
right.
Trump about China.
Yeah.
And there are certainly reasons that China is giving us right now to
mm-hmm.
criticize them, hit them pretty hard. But somebody coming up with a mature, effective, sound and sustainable strategy towards China that does not get us into a new Cold War but stands up for American interests – I think there's been a lot of good work done in the last year sort of exposing the desperate need for a new strategy towards China, but not that much work yet done to actually define what that strategy looks like. And so, again, if I were a candidate or advising a candidate over the next 2 years, it'd be have an answer to that question the day you walk into the Oval Office in 2021.
So real opening for leadership on that issue.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Big time.
Yeah. Well, Jake, this has been so interesting. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for
enjoy
having
New Hampshire. Stay warm.
Will do.
All right. Thanks so much. Thank you so much.
Diplopod is a production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Subscribe to Diplopod on popular podcast platforms such as iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at carnegieendowment.org/diplopod. Tim Martin is our audio engineer. Lauren Duick is our executive producer. I'm Jen Psaki. Thanks for listening.